like an impulse, and when I started, it just kept going. It was almost like, I mean, it wasn't like an out-of-body experience or anything like that, but it was, I just couldn't stop.
That was a clip from David Hoshaw serving two life sentences, finally admitting the words out loud what he did, killing his fiance and her mom back in June of 2007. Now he is ready to confess 18 years after this brutal double murder. Now he talks about the why, the how, and the mental terrain he walked while sending detectives on this wild hunt for a made-up serial killer he created to buy himself 2 years of freedom, and I'll get into that. So while covering the special bond initially between mom and daughter and their life story that was cut short, it was something I was doing at the time with ABC 2020, which is now on Hulu's Bad Romance, and I reached out to Hoshaw in prison, not expecting he'd not only be ready to talk, but to confess and go into detail. The victims, well, they were Angelique, who was 35 years old at the time, and her mom, Vonda Goyena, 74 years old. Here's Vonda's last words on June 30th when calling 911 for help.
Traffic 911, what is the address of your emergency?
I need an ambulance.
Okay.
8436 Green Street and died.
Okay.
Daughter, grab it.
Oh, your daughter's boyfriend? And you don't know if he's still there?
I don't know. I need the police here, please.
Okay, well, get him out there. Do you know if he's still there?
I don't know.
Did he have any weapons?
I need an ambulance. I'm dying.
Okay, did he have any weapons?
What?
Did he have any weapons?
I don't know.
This prison interview I did is to learn what makes someone kill. What's the tipping point and difference between them and us? And at the end, you'll hear analysis with the prosecutor who locked him up. Now, he helps me dive into the mechanisms of human behavior, also correcting some major discrepancies in Hoshaw's narrative, countered by the actual evidence from the crime scene. Now, this isn't just a confession, right? It's an unraveling. A man who refused taking responsibility, even as he was being sentenced to two life sentences in prison. You'll notice I'm not interviewing him in an accusatory way, not as this moral authority, but to listen judgment-free to get answers and information. And that's really how people end up talking. Before we get started, I'd just like to say thanks for being here. I'm Melissa. I've spent years traveling the country, speaking to killers, victims, and their loved ones, chronicling lives touched by violence, yet still tethered to humanity. Now, this is a platform where I'm new to, and I come to just go deeper beyond the headlines without the restrictions of television. Here's a little sneak peek of what I've done. They want justice. They want answers.
What stands out to you about his personality?
What does the family want most of all?
But you were just the last person to see her.
Get
there's
out of my
an arrest
yard
warrant.
And leave.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
Hit subscribe when you get a chance, and for cases told firsthand each week. Now, a few notes before we get into the Hoshaw interview. He will mention a woman named Amanda. To me, she was his motive, the reason he killed, because he wanted to be with Amanda, but he was engaged to and living with Angelique and her mom. Now, Amanda, I've spoken to her several times. She was unaware of his double life and ended up helping detectives at a crucial point when he was in an interrogation room, unaware of a camera recording his conversation. She asked him, very emotional, distraught. She said, did you do this? Did you harm these people? And he uttered the words, I'm sorry, I got crazy. Not an admission, but also an indication of guilt. Also, before Angelique and Amanda came along, both of whom he met on a dating website, Hoshaw had three failed marriages in the past, two of which had documented reports of domestic violence. His first marriage ended in part because Hoshaw was found to be stalking and grooming a 12-year-old girl while he was married and also working in the Air Force. Now, he was discharged, but he wasn't charged. I did ask him about the teen girl, and that was the one question that he just simply would not answer. Now, during the investigation, it took about 2 years because the night of the murder, Hoshaw, he had an alibi. He was 80 miles away at a Boy Scout camp with his son. But a closer look and that alibi slowly broke down, stripped away, and showed that it was possible to kill two people and return to the Boy Scout camp by morning unseen by anyone. So after my prison interview airs with Hoshaw, you'll get some analysis with the prosecutor, Phil Evans, who really pinpoints the psyche of Hoshaw and why people kill. It's an interesting conversation. Stay tuned for that. But for now, here's the 33-minute prison call with double murderer David Hoshaw. Well, this is really the first time you're talking about Vonda and Angelique. And is it because of passing time, or have you accepted everything that's happened?
I don't mind talking about it. It's not that I'm comfortable, because I really am not. It's really a sore subject for me, because it did something terrible.
Is it because of the act itself, or is it because just verbalizing it?
I think it's more because of the act itself that makes me uncomfortable. What else? How to say it?
Well, why don't we start just from the, more so the beginning with this dating website where you met a few of your exes, including Angelique. What was it about using dating websites that you found an appeal in?
Just going to, you know, I've always been an introverted kind of person. And for me, going out to a club or someplace like that, I mean, I'm just not one to go up to somebody and, hey, I'm David, and, you know, and strike up a conversation with somebody. To me, it was just an easier process.
What was it about Angelique that you liked, and how would you describe her?
Well, she seemed very outgoing, which is someone I was looking for. She has had a bubbly kind of personality, which was different from other people I'd been with before. And I guess that was kind of appealing.
What was it about the relationship where you thought, I'm going to marry this girl, I'm going to propose?
Into that one. At the time, before I proposed, you know, things were really, really good between us, and she was accepting of my two kids that I had at the time, and that was always a bonus, you know, because, you know, there's some people that, you know, you meet that don't care for, you know, I don't like the term, but, you know, a lot of people use the term baggage, and you know, kids for some people are a deal breaker, but she was open to them, so, you know, that was rather appealing.
Did she ever meet your children?
Yes, she did. Yeah, with the arrangement I had with my first wife, I got the boys every other weekend, so she had, you know, met him quite a few times.
At what point in the relationship did you feel as though you wanted to meet someone else, or you needed to meet someone else?
It wasn't a point that I wanted to. It was just she had, you know, we had talked together about it, and she was like, she really wanted to know that, you know, we were 100% sure about it, and, you know, that's where we, you know, had the idea of, you know, going and trying to date someone else and see, you know, just to make sure that, you know, us being together was what we really wanted.
Did she actually go and date someone else? Did she ever talk about her efforts in doing so?
Well, we didn't really, you know, make phone calls, you know, because, you know, it was right before I went up to Wisconsin. But that we, you know, had this plan. And so it's not like we called and talked about it, but she made it seem like she did. She never asked me about it. And it wasn't until, you know, I came back down from that trip and everything happened that during that weekend that, you know, that all came out.
But before that occurred, you went back to a website and you met someone. Tell me about Amanda.
You know, that I met on, you know, like you said, I met her on another web. She was great. You know, fell in love with her right away. You know, I always, you know, people always say, you know, it was love at first sight. And, you know, I never really believed that, but until that encounter. And she just, I don't know, just took my breath away, so to speak.
Were you already engaged at this point? And how long were you seeing Amanda when you realized, okay, I need to break things off with Angelique?
Yes, we were engaged, and it was almost right away. You know, after I, you know, like I said, when I met Amanda, it was, you know, love at first sight, and we went out a couple times, and I just knew that. You know, the more I spent with Amanda, more time I spent with Amanda, I knew that I needed to break things off. And for me, you know, just over the phone or an email just wasn't going to do it. I had to, it was the type of thing that had to be done in person. But, you know, I had, with my oldest son, Jonathan, you know, he had summer camp that week, and I flew back on a Saturday, got back Saturday evening, and had to have everything packed and for camping on Sunday morning. And, you know, I knew to break things off and to get through all that, it would take more than just a couple hours of what would turn out to be probably arduous, which is what happened when I did come back to confront her.
So tell me about the urgency, though, of leaving and going that night versus going for breakfast or meeting her for coffee. What was the urgency of that particular night, June 30th?
Well, as I told you before, my stepfather was there that last night at camp. And he told me I need to let her know as soon as possible. And it was just weighing on my heart. And, I mean, it sounds kind of bad the way I just said that, but it was just on my mind. And I tried, you know, sleeping, going to bed that night, but I was just like, his words were ringing in my mind. And I was like, yes, I need to go do this. And which I would have waited till the morning. But can't go back and unwind the clock.
During the 2-hour drive to her house, how were you thinking the night would have played out?
I really don't remember what I was thinking. I thought we would go and get things, you know, hashed out. I would tell her, you know, that there was someone else and that, you know, things were over and that I would just go back to camp. But, you know, it didn't quite work out that way.
Okay. When you arrived to the house, was she awake?
No, she wasn't. I let myself in, and when I went to, she was actually in the bedroom. I mean, she might have been laying there, but I don't know. But when I opened the door, she, you know, bolted up. So, you know, I'm pretty
How did that conversation escalate? Just walk me through that night.
Oh boy. Yeah, this is making me a little uncomfortable. Let me see here. When I went into the bedroom, like I said, she bolted upright, you know, in bed, and you know, she came over, gave me a hug to begin with. She had no idea what I was going to say to her, but as we were talking, she started to cry, and she went from hurt to anger, and she started yelling, and she started to get physical, hitting me. There was a lot of crying on her part. I mean, I'm an emotional person too, and her emotions got my emotions going, and then she, of course, her hurtfulness turned to anger, and it just kind of escalated from there.
Where did it go from yelling, physical altercation, to that next level? And how did a weapon come into play? Where did it come from?
It was my knife I had. I had a bureau there in the bedroom, and she had actually gotten up to go grab it. She knew where it was. And she's the one that grabbed it to begin with, and she started to swing it at me, and I was able to stay out of the way, but I grabbed her arms and then grabbed it out of her hand. And just the emotion and intensity of the situation carried it to what happened. There was no thought process on mine, like, oh, I need to take this and do what I did. It just kind of happened.
When it comes to being in that situation, was it an impulse that you felt in the moment you couldn't control? Why not just run, for example, run?
Sorry about that. It was like an impulse. And when I started, it just kept going. It was almost like, it wasn't like an out-of-body experience or anything like that, but it was, I just couldn't stop once I got started.
Was she fighting back at all, or was she taking cover at this point?
Well, she started by fighting back, but then she started screaming, and she didn't really, the room we were in was not very big at all, and the bed was right there in the middle. We were still on the bed, so when she got the knife, we had fallen back onto the bed, so there was really nowhere to go.
When you said that you just couldn't stop,
right? Sorry.
Was it that physically, emotionally, mentally? And what were you afraid of in that moment? What was the anger in that moment when it comes to the breakup and it escalating that in that way? What was the fear to where you felt like you had to take her life?
Like I said, I wasn't really thinking. It just, she had got the knife and introduced that into our argument, and it was, I don't want to say instinct, but almost like I was trying to defend myself. But I don't know. I just couldn't stop. I don't know what else I can say about it.
How long do you think that was until Vonda knocks on the door? Is that how it happened? Vonda came knocking?
The door was shut, and we had a lock on the door because Vonda, you know, had the habit of getting up and just walking in the room in the middle of the night. And so the door was locked, and she had come in, or she had tried to come in. She got up and was knocking on the door and jiggling the door handle. So she never actually came in the door, into the room, I mean. As far as how long it was, I really do not know. I couldn't really say one way or the other. I never really looked at, you know, a watch or a clock or anything like that, or I couldn't even begin to give you a rough estimate of a few minutes. I guess. I don't know.
But before
before
you opened the door, you knew in that moment that Angelique was already dead?
I did not know whether she was or was not. When I opened the door, you know, Vonda was there, and I kind of shoved her out of the way, and then she chased me down the hallway and started trying to hit me, and I was still, you know, whether it was emotion or I was just so hyped up, I really don't know. And I turned around and I attacked her back. And I didn't know whether either one of them was, you know, still alive or dead at the time. And I got my keys and left the house.
Do you remember your state of mind at that point? Were you thinking, how did that just happen? Were you trying to calm yourself down? You had a 2-hour drive.
Yeah, I was, for lack of a better term, scared shitless, you know, pardon my French. but I was freaking out, and, you know, I just got my vehicle and left. And like I said, I had no idea what their condition was. I couldn't even tell you. I didn't even know how many times I had stabbed either one of them. I really didn't know at the time.
Were you surprised when you found out after?
Yes. And I didn't find out until after they arrested me and they were talking to me about it. Because before I was arrested, they never really went into detail. They just said that they had been stabbed. You know, they never gave me any kind of a number or times or anything like that. It wasn't until I was arrested that I found those details out. To be honest with you, I couldn't even tell you what they are anymore. I literally blocked that out of my mind. I don't want to say it's really terrorized me thinking about it, but it makes me very uncomfortable, and I know that I can't change what has happened.
When you walked back into the Boy Scout camp and you laid your head down, if you could even sleep that night, how did you wake up the next morning as if those two murders didn't occur? I mean, you were surrounded with family, friends, Boy Scout leader at the time. How did you make that mental switch?
It was difficult. I definitely didn't forget about it by any stretch of the means. When I first got back to camp, the first thing I did is I headed And when you know, that they got everybody up in the morning, as time is just packing, and I just kept myself busy with packing, you know, tearing down the camp and packing up and trying to get out of there.
How did life carry on for you at that point? Were you walking on eggshells thinking, I didn't really clean up, I just left, it's a matter of time?
To be honest, yes, I did think that. It was just a matter of time. And it was just a little bit longer time than I envisioned at first. but it was very difficult. Eggshells would be a good way of saying it. I was walking on eggshells.
But the thing is, there wasn't really a lot of, I mean, you live there, so your DNA was everywhere along with your fingerprints. So there was really no evidence tying you to the two murders. And so what made you go one step further in covering your tracks? What was that thought process? Because you hadn't been arrested or charged or anything.
Right. Well, Angelique and Bond's family, her sisters, had called me more than once on the phone, and they said, "We know what you did, and you know, the police are going to come get you," and things of that nature. And it just really freaked me out. You know, it made me think that, hey, there's some way they're getting ready to come get me. And so I thought I had to do something. And I should have just done that.
So what was the goal in writing the two letters, and why two? Why not just one?
The goal, I guess I was trying to send the police on a wild goose chase, so to speak, and to try to make it seem like it was somebody that was, or as why I did more than one. I really, I don't know, to be honest with you. I never really thought about it. I wrote one, and I didn't know whatever happened to that, whether it had actually made it to the police or not. And so I said, well, maybe I'll write another one. And just to make sure, I guess was probably the reason why I wrote a second one. Wasn't that I had said, oh, let me write two letters.
And how did you prevent any DNA or fingerprints on there? Again, no evidence on the letters either.
Right.
How was that possible?
I put latex gloves on. I had long sleeves on. And then on top of the latex gloves, I put another pair of gloves on. And instead of licking the envelope, I took, I can't remember what I used, a Q-tip or exactly how I did it, but I used water to moisten the flap on the envelope. And of course, stamps are, you no longer flick the stamps, so those are all sticky.
It's very thought out and methodical. So, I mean, so that kind of leads to the next question, is there's having remorse and not wanting to be caught still, because you want to be free, or
Right. It's
having remorse to where it's weighing on you and you want to turn yourself in. How did you teeter between any of those?
I definitely, I did feel remorse, but it wasn't to the point where I was going to confess. And I was just trying to stay free. I was by just about any means I could. And could, you know.
Fast forward to 2 years past. Tell me about those 2 years where you're with Amanda, who you said she was the one for you. Love at first sight. You were burying this secret pretty deep. Tell me about those 2 years.
In the beginning of those 2 years when I, you know, went ahead and, you know, moved all my stuff up there, the first few months, probably almost 6 months, was very difficult, especially on the anniversary, you know, of the month, you know, which was the 30th. Every 30th of the month, it was very difficult for me. I didn't want to be alone. And, you know, at the time, we weren't living together or anything like that, but I told her, I never told her anything about the situation, other than that they had been killed. I made it seem like, you know, that somebody else had done it. You know, I never told her until I was arrested and I was at the police station. But anyway, on the 30th of each month, for I want to say at least 6 months, you know, I convinced her. I was like, I can't be alone tonight. And she stayed with me each night. But it was rough. And as time went on, it was a little bit easier, but I was still in the back of my mind thinking, okay, any day now.
Just tell me about that moment when, you know, a detective says, I'm going to give you guys privacy. And she blurts out, and you blurt out, it was two words, but did you think, police took it as a partial confession. Did you think it was recording? Did you think twice in retrospect that that could have been taken as a confession?
It's my naivete, I guess, at the time. When they said it's going to be private, that's what I took that to be. And I didn't even, it didn't occur to me that they were still recording. And after I had finally, you know, a year and a half or so later, when my lawyer showed me the video, I was like, man, I had no idea that sitting straight across this little pinhole camera, and, you know, I had been living with this secret for, you know, the past 2 years, and when she asked me straight up, I had intentions of spending the rest of my life with her, and I wasn't going to continue to lie to her. I mean, she'd been told whatever she had been told by the police. I know that she had seen the crime scene photos. And so I just felt like I couldn't lie to her about it.
Also, at the time, she was pregnant?
Yes, which really upset me that the police would show her what they showed her. She was 4.5 months pregnant.
At that point, you still planned to fight the charges, but you didn't end up going to trial. How come you took the plea deal?
My lawyers, you know, the whole time up until I discussed with them, the day I took the plea, it was probably just a few days prior to that when I, you know, changed my mind, made the decision. But up until that point where I changed my mind, the lawyers were like, okay, this evidence we're going to get, they're not going to be able to present this. You're going to go free, this, that, and the other. And up until then, up until they brought me in and showed me the video of my interrogation there when I got arrested, you know, up until then, you know, they said, oh, they've got nothing. You're going to be fine. But when they they showed that to me. They told me, my lawyers told me, they said, with this, you're going to get found guilty, and they're going to give you the death penalty. And they laid that on me, like, you know, at least if you change your plea, you'll get life in prison, and you'll be able to have a relationship with your kids and everybody versus the death. So that's what weighed on me or convinced me that I needed to plead guilty.
But at the time, and I could be wrong, but it was perceived as you weren't really saying you were guilty at that time. You were saying you were going to plead guilty to spare your family. Were you still in that state of mind of not actually coming out with the words and saying, I did it?
Yeah, it was extremely hard for me, and I was still trying to play off like it wasn't me, but that was just me, whether it be shame or just guilt. I really don't know.
What would you say to the family? Because I know they have not wanted to talk to you or hear from you, but what would you say to them?
I would tell them that I'm, you know, even though it probably doesn't mean much to them, I would want to apologize and say, you know, I did not have any intention for any of this to happen, and I wish that I could go back and undo things and set it straight. I mean, I wish I would have thought a little bit more that night, and instead of saying, oh, I've got to go down there tonight and take care of this, I would have just waited till the next day. Because I had no intention of any of this happening.
Who were you as a man in these relationships?
Really, I was a lost individual, to be honest. But as far as how I was, I did give gifts. I thought I was charming. I don't know. Nobody told me I wasn't. But I always tried to make people laugh and try to make people happy. And when I stopped being effective at that, it is kind of when things started to turn bad, I guess, you know, for the relationships.
Why rush into these engagements?
Yeah, looking back, I do believe that. You know, I've always hated to be alone, and that was a big part of the problem. As far as going from relationship to relationship, I just couldn't be a bachelor.
When you think about Angelique today and over the past 15 years, what do you think about? What goes through your mind?
Just the regret for what happened. She was a lovely person. It didn't deserve what happened. Truly, I'm sorry for all the shame I brought to people, for all the hurt I brought to people. That never in a million years thought I'd be in this situation.
It's infuriating listening to him. It's infuriating to me to hear his side of the story. And I, Phil, what your reaction listening to him?
Well, I've said this, Melissa and I have talked about this on other occasions. And the thing about David Hoshaw is I've prosecuted hundreds of killers. I've talked after convictions to killers. And the thing about David Hoshaw that's really a cautionary tale is the way he presents himself to everyone. He is sort of the victim of all of life. Every situation he's just struggling to do to get by. And at the root, he's extremely narcissistic. He wants to control this narrative. And he literally is talking about the brutal way in which he killed his fiance. And he tries to blame this all on an impulse. When he planned, he talked to Amanda in Wisconsin up until 11 o'clock at night, shut off his phone, drove 80 miles over country roads. He used his key to enter a house. He came and he stabbed Angel 37 times at least, and he never cut himself, which anyone who's aware of how someone uses a knife, especially on a hot, muggy June night, he obviously had a glove or he came prepared with a knife with a hilt so that he could continue to stab without injuring himself. He finished off Angel and he moved to the living room and then set upon a 74-year-old. So it's completely infuriating that he is now sort of saying, well, these women fought with me. We know they didn't fight with him. Angel never raised herself up from the bed. She was stabbed where she was sleeping, and she was still planning their wedding while he was planning his next relationship.
And Phil, I mean, just looking at the crime scene photo that Melissa put in there, it's evident. I mean, you ever anybody who has taken blood spatter 101 and, crime scene analysis 101 can tell that's where the murder happened, was there on that bed. So it's to me, it's just jaw-dropping that he thinks he can go with this narrative that it was in self-defense this whole time when all of this evidence points otherwise.
Well, and the thing, Kelly, about him is you have to understand, and that's why I say he's a cautionary tale. If you look at his entire life, his first wife, the son he took to the Boy Scout camp was the same son that he strangled his first wife in front of, at the same time that he was courting, in his mind, a 12-year-old and tried to excuse that behavior. So he is someone who reframes himself, controls the narrative, and clearly, when he was talking in this interview, as a prosecutor or anyone in law enforcement, you always want to hear a killer talk, get them talking. So, what he does when he starts talking is he really gives you insight into who he really is. And everything that we thought he had planned about the murder, we know he did because we knew when he sent those letters. He had taken tactics to ensure there would be no forensic evidence on him. And what does he tell Melissa in this interview? I wore gloves. I then put on a long sleeve shirt. I then wore additional set of gloves. I used a little Q-tip swab. And so clearly he's someone who plans ahead. When he drove those 80 some miles, he made sure that he left his easy pass back at the Boy Scout camp so that when he went through the tunnels and bridges where it would activate, it wouldn't be there. So you have someone who presents as the way he did, and you tend to not see him as dangerous as perhaps the street, gang killer who looks more dangerous to you. But David Hoshaw is clearly more diabolical. He clearly seize this opportunity to talk to again recharacterize who he was, and that, oh, this just all got out of hand.
And I want to add on to that. It was his MO. When you talk to other people that he dated in his past, he had a habit of breaking up with them in awkward, abrupt ways in the middle of the night. So this was his way to throw the woman at the time off completely.
Kelly, when he did plead guilty, any defendant has a right to make a statement to the court. And one of the things he said at that time, and this is 3 years after the homicide, by the time these charges and we get a trial date, he said, I never once wished any ill will towards either of them or wished that either of them had died. Now, obviously, 37 stab wounds and numerous cut wounds to Angel, he made sure that she was dead. And then he said, I'm a loving and caring husband, father, son, brother, uncle, friend, mentor, and provider. And that's why I say individuals like David Hoshaw are some of the most dangerous people because in society, we don't see them. They don't present as someone who we should be afraid of.
Yeah, and I think that's also, why it took him so many years to come clean is because of that shame and because of that guilt. But I want to talk about that impulse control is when he said it was just an impulse, because I have interviewed other convicted killers who mentioned that as well, even a teen. Tell me what the word impulse is to you in comparison to the premeditation and then just the whole lack of emotional and physical regulation that makes a killer so different from all of us.
Well, the interesting thing about impulse with David Hoshaw is that it's clear from every objective fact that his entire action that night was premeditated. He went in with a knife. He went in the middle of the night. He surprised Angel in her bedroom. He had one reason to go there, and he was going to take her life. So the only thing I will give him is that once he started stabbing her, internally, some part of him was enthralled with the action and he continued to do it. So he didn't control himself at that point. However, to cast the entire situation as an impulsive action, an impulse means that you're confronted, perhaps you're in an argument or there is some heated moment and you lash out. This was premeditation. Once he had dispatched Angel and the medical examiner said that he literally stabbed her in her side and back after she was already dead. He then had a break, moved down the hallway, and still had the wherewithal to attack a 74-year-old woman sitting in a chair. So I don't see impulse, maybe in the amount of wounds, but in the act of taking these two lives, it was clearly premeditated, just like his drive back to the Boy Scout camp, washing up, hiding the knife. The next day, he didn't come back to Norfolk. He wanted to make sure that someone else found the bodies. So he intentionally delayed his return to Norfolk and he stopped at a house of an individual that he wasn't planned to stop at. And so it's very clear that he was calculated in his behavior.
And also interesting is he said he had remorse, but not enough to turn himself in. He said Amanda was the love of his life, although he knew he was engaged to Angel at the time. His behavior, what do you think women are to him? What did you find and uncover from this pattern?
Essentially, he saw women as an entity that could make his life better. And if he didn't view you as somehow propping him up, making him feel better about yourself, himself, he was moving on. When he was married to his first wife, not only did he assault her, at the same time, he was trying to engage in a relationship with a 12-year-old girl that resulted in him being kicked out of the military. And so that's a cautionary tale because his entire life, and sadly, Angel and Vonda's death, to my mind as a prosecutor, could have been prevented if those first actions of domestic violence and also being a child predator were dealt with properly.
Again, because there were so many signs if you had all of that information, but these women that he dated, they weren't privy. I interviewed many of them. They did not know about his history. What I also find interesting is how some things were truthful, how he detailed the wild goose chase and pretending this alleged serial killer was to blame. What did that feel like knowing you put 2 years of your life with meticulous police work with Detective Malbon? How was that hearing him talk about how he did it intentionally?
Well, it confirmed what we already knew. I mean, we knew that he had sent those letters to try to give the police another suspect or suspects. And he put information in the letters that clearly someone who knew Angel, knew her activities, would only be privy to. So to us in 2007, as we are moving forward and we're getting everything analyzed at the lab, we are making sure that the entire landscape has been investigated, but it's clear that those letters were sent really because he was, in a sense, reliving what he did. The first letter, he clearly starts talking almost in a bad, romance novel of some sort of intimate action that a fictitious person had with Angel. And this is literally within weeks of her being buried. The extent of his callous nature, as I said earlier, he rented a U-Haul to move his possessions the day his fiancée was being buried. And he never went, and he didn't send flowers. He didn't call anyone in the family. He just left and he started a new relationship. It's interesting, the one picture that was shown to the viewers where he was standing with a woman in a hotel lobby. That picture was actually taken on June 15th when he was out in Wisconsin, and Angel was calling him to come back to Virginia so they could work on the wedding because she knew he had to go to the Boy Scout camp. So you can see that he's already moved forward because Angel no longer can serve him or his life.
And also, just to wrap this up, it's important to reiterate the fact that Amanda, who he was seeing and living with and had children with, she had no idea anything about Angel, that she existed. She was completely, bombarded with literally officers kicking down her door and breaking in early in the morning. She had no idea. She was completely thrown off, and her life was devastated, as well as, the other victims impacted.
All right. And of course, once again, this is David Hoshaw picking and choosing what he tells to people about his life. So to her, he had said that his past fiance, he never told her he was still engaged to Angel when this happened. He said his past girlfriend had been killed, and that upset him. But he never opened the window any wider, which was, again, the cautionary tale that throughout a 10 to 12 year time frame, through three wives and one fiance, he used each of them. He controlled the narrative and he was trying to control their lives. And when he couldn't, with respect to Angel and Vonda, he brutally killed them.
What do you think stood out most about, because that's, the interview was just new information since, he took the deal and was sentenced to do two life sentences. What's your takeaway from hearing him speak and how his mind rationalizes and reasons things? Again, some falsities, some discrepancies, some truth all mixed into one. What was your takeaway?
I think it's interesting because you have to get past hearing he presents in a meek fashion. He's obviously posturing towards you as a female, and he's presenting himself not as a threatening individual, and he wants to be give you a little introspection. All it does to me is again reiterate, if you look objectively at the facts, he's trying in this interview to control the narrative of David Hoshaw because he knows it's his one chance to tell that tale. I also think that I knew that he and Amanda did not have contact. And in a sense, he's again trying to throw this out to Amanda because he wants to try to have contact with his sons by her. And, it's one of those things that it just reaffirms that he was a very calculating individual. What he admitted factually in the interview about the letters and everything just shows the extent. If he went to that extent with the letters, then you know darn well that the planning for this midnight run to commit a double homicide was well planned out and executed.
One other discrepancy that's important to mention, just for the case and also the family, he mentions that he was in agreement. He had a conversation with Angelique about, hey, let's explore other people. Let's see how it goes before we get married to make sure that we want to marry each other and we're each other's person. That was never true. That was completely false.
No,
We know that did not happen. Angel never brought that up.
that's correct. And one of the things that caught, there are two things that really caused Hoshaw to decide that, I'm not going to be able to go to court and win this. Number one was he tried to keep that statement he made in the interview room to Amanda out, and that was litigated in court. And his request to deny that access was the court refused it, and that was coming into evidence. The other thing that was going to come into evidence was parts of Amanda's diary, where she very dutifully, day by day, talked about the planning for the wedding. And we had no, numerous witnesses that talked about how she was doing everything. She was getting all the invites out that David hadn't done anything. There was a, the invitations were going out and everything she was doing to prepare for the wedding. So his statement that they were exploring other options, again, that's part of him trying to control the narrative, trying to make himself seem like less of the disgusting individual he was in the way he treated Angel, who only sought to love him. This was her one chance at age 35. She was taking care of her mother, who was elderly. Her father, she had taken care of before that. So this was her chance in life, to finally have her own relationship.
Prosecutor Phil Evans, thank you so much for joining me. You have done so much for your community and the cases that you have worked, especially this one. I really appreciate you coming on and analyzing the mind of David Hoshaw. You know, Kelly and I, a while ago, we started Killer Genes, a podcast. We did incredible, remarkable investigations. I just wanted to take it to YouTube, bring it to life visual with some of our refurbished investigations, along with news stories such as this. Things that you've never heard before. So when you get a chance, follow Killer Genes on YouTube. Kelly will make an appearance at one point because there's some cases of hers that are really important that we want to keep alive. Kelly, thank you for all that you do in the CrimeCon world and crime, you know, HQ. Thank you.